It's sort of nice having a studio that you can look out from.
Yeah, although we have sort of been inundated by skyscrapers around here. It used to be we could look out the north side and see all the way across Central Park up to Harlem.
Oh, my God, yeah, it's all been
that's
shut
gone.
In.
Then in this direction, we've got the Hutton Building, which has blocked our view of Fifth Avenue. And Mr. Paley put a new high-rise over the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah.
So we now have rather low-rise views. So you've been interested in architecture for a long time.
All my life, ever since I was a little tiny boy, I've been really interested in it. And it wasn't until I got to college and found out how unsympathetic to me the courses were that were required in order to get into architecture school that I decided to make it an avocation and not a vocation, which, of course, had a great advantage because now I'm bound to know more about architecture as a non-architect than any architect would because they're too busy.
And you've been writing about architecture.
And I write about it and have written about it all my life. And then I've sort of collected architects the way other people collect coins and stamps and things. And there's scarcely an architect who has slipped through my fingers in the last 30 or 40 years except the great Louis Kahn, whom I met, but I didn't really ever know.
Of course, the focal point of your interest in architecture now is Frank Lloyd Wright, and this is a wonderful book. And the reason I thought it was so interesting was that, of course, I knew of Frank Lloyd Wright. I knew of his buildings. I passed the Guggenheim all the time. I've seen pictures of running water, falling water, I guess it's
falling water.
And so I was certainly aware of Frank Lloyd Wright's reputation, but I didn't know anything about him, really. And during his prominence and the sexual scandals and all of that, I didn't know anything about that. I was too young. So there were revelations in this book. But you had a personal relationship with Frank Lloyd Wright, and a lot of it is detailed toward the end of your book. Tell me about your acquaintance with Wright.
Well, when he was coming to New York around from 1950 on, toward the end of his life, when he was in his 80s and he was engaged in trying to get the Guggenheim Museum finally built, it took 17 years between the time he started work on the drawings and the time it actually was constructed. And it wasn't opened until just after his death in 1959. But in any event, he came to New York. He would stay at the Plaza to oversee the building of the Guggenheim and of another wonderful building, the Beth Shalom Synagogue outside Philadelphia. And I used to like to do stories about him in the New Yorker magazine, and he used to like to have stories done about him because he adored publicity. And so we became, first it was a reportorial relationship, and then it became that of true friendship, and we were, I think, amused by each other, and then I came to know him well enough to visit him out at Taliesin in Wisconsin. And after his death, and in the ensuing almost 30 years, I remained friends with Olga Vanna, his wife, and with his children, grandchildren. One of his sons, David, is still alive at the age of 92 in Phoenix. And so it seemed very natural to me to want to write about him in the form of a personal memoir, and then it became increasingly obvious as well as increasingly fun from my point of view to write as much of the whole life as I could. So it turned out to be quite a big fat book instead of just a short personal memoir.
You have a wonderful episode that takes place at the 21 Club where you and Frank Lloyd Wright encountered Ayn Rand. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, at first when she wrote her miserable, trashy classic, as I call it, a really disgusting book from my point of view, preaching that we should all be as intensely selfish as possible. And to my astonishment, that book, The Fountainhead, has remained a bestseller year after year after year. I don't know who reads it and who then believes it. I hope nobody, but everybody.
Well, everybody. I was going to college, everybody read it. I carried it around with me in my back pocket as a paperback. We all read Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead.
It's a dreadful message.
Then we grew up.
In any event, she did model unquestionably the Rourke, the hero of The Fountainhead, after Frank Lloyd Wright. Frank pretended to be chagrined by the fact that Rourke was tall and red-haired, and he wanted the hero to be more like him, which is to say short and white-haired. But she became something of a pest to him because her admiration for him was not something that gave him a great deal of pleasure. They saw each other, and at one time he even contemplated designing a house for her. But by the time he and I were there in the bar at 21, and she came along and was doing her bowing and waving and saying Lieber Meister, this and that, he groaned with dismay. He wanted to be as far from her as possible by that time. although he himself loved being made much of as a celebrity and as a public figure. And he found it as tempting as Mark Twain used to do. You can divide the world up among those people, I think, who really like to be made much of and to be publicly recognized, and those who cringe and hide from it. And Frank Lloyd Wright was certainly one of the former. He got a great deal of pleasure out of his fame. He was delighted when one of his granddaughters, Ann Baxter, became a famous movie actress, and she would introduce him to all the celebrities in Hollywood, and he was like a country yokel about seeing them, and he would always insist on calling them all by their first names at once. He got much pleasure out of that.
Well, it's obvious in reading Minnie Mask that you were fond of Frank Lloyd Wright, and yet you take him to task in many respects, too. For example, you say that he actually was not very truthful about many of the pertinent facts in his life, and you go into great detail about his own autobiography. Tell me about that.
Yes, well, he wrote this extraordinary autobiography, which is a kind of Whitman-esque chanting or incantatory prose, and I always knew, and everybody knew, that much of it was untrue, but when I began to analyze it very closely and to discover things about his life that I think nobody else has ever discovered, it turned out that almost every page of it was a tissue of lies, that he invented everything. And some people might excuse it on the grounds that it was a poetic, view of the life that he wished he had had rather than the life he had had. But in every case, the lies are self-serving, and so it isn't just poetry. If the rest of us tried to get away with it on the grounds of poetry, I think it would be laughed out of the room. It was necessary to him to lie like that, but sometimes he was so dexterous at it, and he took such pleasure in it, that he would sometimes lie as a demonstration of his virtuosity. There was nothing to be gained from many of the lies he told. And he would even tell them around the family dinner table or with friends, and then they would catch him out and say, "This is nonsense." And he would then always say with perfect good temper, "Well, there you are." He never pretended to defend a lie once he was found out. He
his age, for example.
Else.
Why? Why? He looked 2 years off of
yeah,
his age.
Well, I think he wanted very much to be a prodigy, and he wasn't a prodigy. He was a dropout from college. He didn't get good grades in the very few courses that he did take before he dropped out. He had not been anything like the prodigy that his great hero, Louis Sullivan, had been. And in an attempt, I think, first to imitate Sullivan and get to be as close to being a prodigy as possible, he thought he would lop off a couple of years of his life. So although he was born in 1867, he pretended to have been born in 1869. And that also fitted in with his notion that as a great man, and he always believed himself to be a great man, that there should have been all kinds of portents celebrating calling attention to his birth. So he had or gave himself a kind of legendary birth with a lot of nonsense about his mother having wanted him to be an architect when he was still in her womb and all that. There isn't a shred of evidence he ever had any such intention at all. And there weren't any architects where he was growing up in the Middle West at that time. But he ran away from home, came to Chicago, had gained a few rudiments of technical knowledge of engineering through working as a kind of office boy in a civil engineer's office in Madison, Wisconsin. Got a job as a draftsman in Chicago, then soon came to work for Adler & Sullivan, which was the hottest architectural firm in Chicago at that time. And by the time he was 21, he was the head draftsman at Adler & Sullivan and was working very closely with Louis Sullivan, who was one of the two or three greatest architects of that time. So he became the prodigy that he always intended to be. And from that moment on, there was no stopping him. But I think that creative people do tend to, Cole Porter, another person whom I've written about, he lopped off a couple of years from his age as well. He wanted to be a prodigy when he arrived in Yale, and he wasn't a prodigy. He was a little bit behind himself.
You also say that Wright was, in effect, a con man. Huh? In what way?
He was a wonderful con. He was a kind of Mississippi riverboat gambler. There was no, and he dressed like one, you know. He was always sartorially so splendid with a cape and a cap and a special, always carried a cane, not because he needed it, but because he wanted it for gesturing purposes. And there was nothing that he couldn't sell you. He would have sold me a secondhand car instantly, even if he had already taken the engine out of it.
Or a three-legged chair.
Or any to tip over in. And Most architects are very skillful at selling themselves. It's to some extent, it is a profession that requires snake oil salesmen, and he was consummately that. And as well as that, he was a genius. The work is there. My book isn't an attempt to debunk him, because the work is there. Anybody can go and see that this man was a very great architect. But at the same time, he had all these characteristics of the confidence man. And when I asked Arthur Miller about what his impression of Frank Lloyd Wright was, he said instantly, he reminded me of W.C. Fields. And, of course, there is that in Fields, of the confidence man, of the sartorial, the odd, wonderful dresser, and of the a kind of magical quality which Wright certainly had. And indeed, he was so magical that Arthur Miller, in his recent autobiography, describes Wright as having been a tall man, which would have pleased Wright very much. But he was short, and Miller, who was 6 feet two or so, was truly tall, and yet so powerful was the impression Frank made on him that he remembers him as having been a tall man.
Now, Frank Lloyd Wright must have made millions of dollars in his career, and yet you say he was always broke.
He was always broke. He was always overextended. He wanted to live like a millionaire without being a millionaire, and he was unfortunately much more unscrupulous about not paying debts, not even paying tradespeople, not paying for the butcher or the baker, than anybody, ordinary folk like us. We'd be terrified of not paying our bills. And in and around Spring Green, Wisconsin, where he lived, those are the stories that are still being told about him 30 years after his death, that he simply didn't pay his bills. They don't recognize him yet there as a great man. They simply recognize him as a local eccentric who was not to be trusted. And there was something in him that wanted him to push himself to the brink, to take chances, to be on the edge of catastrophe, and that seemed to give him an extra energy, caused him to feel a more intense sense of life. Most of us wouldn't dare to do that.
For a man who was born and lived during a sexually repressed period in our country, he was certainly liberated sexually. Tell me about this.
Well, he became liberated, but it took him a long time. When he married at 21, a young woman at 18, they were both virgins. In effect, plunged into each other. They had six children in rapid succession. He was a husband and father, a suburban husband and father in Oak Park, Illinois, just outside Chicago, for 20 years. And for 20 years, he worked like mad, did his best to remain a domestic creature, but found the rewards of domesticity increasingly sparse. And when he was just over 40, having fallen in love with the wife of a good friend of his, May Marcini, her name was, he and May Mar decamped, and he abandoned his wife and six children, and never properly returned to them. He and May Mar spent a year abroad, and then he came back and started building his great house of Taliesin in Spring Green. And then in a frightful accident, a servant in the house set fire to the house, and as Mema and her two children and several other people in the house were seeking to escape from the blaze, he butchered them with an axe. So six or seven people were killed in a few minutes in this blaze of the destruction of Taliesin. And that was the major catastrophe of Frank's life. And of course, many people, especially at that time, this is the time of the First World War, assumed that this was God's punishment, that he was exacting on Frank for Frank's unconventional sexual conduct. In that case, of course, they would have had to explain why all these innocent people were also murdered. It's not a very attractive God that is called for in that particular scenario.
That must have made headlines across the
tremendous
country.
Headlines all over the world, because he was already a celebrated figure, and his scandalous decampment with Mema had also made headlines in the Chicago Tribune banner headlines and in the New York press as well.
What year was that?
1914, just at the time of the First World War.
We don't think of crimes like that happening.
Well, you know, there was a yellow press, as it was called then, more scandalous than the press we have today. And nobody had any particular weapon against it. People are much more litigious now. They sue much more readily if anybody tries to say anything scandalous about one's life. But then after Mammoth's horrible murder, shortly thereafter, he fell in love with Miriam Noel, who turned out to be schizophrenic, turned out to be mad, really, and they lived together for several years. And by the time he got a divorce successfully, first from his first wife, with whom he had never got a divorce, then secondly from Miriam, he had fallen in love with another woman, Olga Vanna Milanov, a beautiful young Montenegrin who had come to this country, was a dancer in the Gurdjieff group. And they had a child outside marriage, and it wasn't until that child was about six that Frank was able to marry Olga Vanna, and they sent out a wedding announcement with the photograph of the six-year-old child on the wedding announcement to indicate that that was straightened out at last. And then I think after his third marriage to Olga Vanna, which took place in his 50s, she kept him on a fairly short tether. And whatever he may have done or wanted to have done after that point for the succeeding 35-odd years, Olga Vanna was pretty much in charge of.
Tell me about Taliesin. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Taliesin. It was a great country estate in Spring Green, Wisconsin, which he named after a legendary Welsh bard and king and wizard named Taliesin. And then subsequently, at the time of the Second World War, he built another Taliesin West, in the very late 30s, outside Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona, a great, extraordinary, prehistoric-looking stone and concrete and wood fortress in the desert there where he spent his winters. And he went back and forth between the two Taliesins, where he had then by that time set up also a fellowship of 40 or 50 young people coming there to work with him, not to be taught by him, he said he was never a teacher, but to be in his presence and to learn something of the nature of his philosophy about what architecture ought to be, what building ought to be. And that fellowship continues to this day. It has survived his death. It is still going on. The two Taliesins still have a fellowship in existence.
One thing struck me as I was reading your biography. There were some large projects, the Johnson's Wax project, the Guggenheim, the project that was in Buffalo. I can't remember the name of that.
The Larkin Building.
Yes, the Larkin Building. But it seemed to me that he took on so many small projects, little houses here and there. So it didn't seem to matter to him whether the project was large or small.
Well, to his great credit, and unlike most of the celebrated architects we have today, he was preoccupied all his life long with attempting to produce low-cost housing for the greatest possible number of people in the greatest possible number of places. He was really dedicated to the notion that we all should be properly sheltered, and in his case it meant we should all be sheltered by Frank Lloyd Wright. And he did develop, by 1940, his first Usonian house, as he called it, which the cost of which at that time he had got down to just over $5,000. It was a very inexpensive house, and he got that by a series of innovations that nobody else had ever experimented with successfully. He gave up the garage in favor of what he called the carport, which is now a commonplace in houses. He abandoned the basement. There's no cellar in this house. He poured a concrete slab on a gravel bed and then had heating in that concrete slab. So he developed for the first time almost since the Roman period a radiant heating that was very successful and very inexpensive compared to conventional heating. The houses had flat roofs, which were also cheap, and therefore, however, couldn't get FHA mortgages from the federal government, which didn't believe in flat roofs. But again and again, he tried to develop this kind of ancient, safe, snug shelter, not unlike a cave where you had a hearth at your back, a strong either stone or brick hearth, and the fire burning on the hearth, and then floor-to-ceiling windows facing south. The sun would come in so you could look out at the world, but where you were safe from the world, and you gathered your strength and around the family hearth at night, and you were snug and secure. And he really believed in that, and he really achieved that. And I think that that's the major contribution that he gave to American architecture, the production of a kind of house that was natural, that we feel good in. And it was a very far cry from the kind of box house where it was one box with a lot of little box rooms inside one big box, which, as he felt, was untrue to how we ought to live And I think he was right.
And yet, you say in Mini Mask that in most of his projects, the cost exceeded what the expectations were, and also his roofs always leaked.
Yes, that's the heartbreaking thing, and especially in respect to the roofs, that he never seemed to be able to get a roof that didn't leak, and it became vexatious to him, but so common that he just developed a series of one-liners where somebody would complain about his roof leaking. Frank would say, well, that's how you can tell it's a roof. Or he would simply say, as Hib Johnson in a famous episode called him when at Thanksgiving dinner at Wingspread Johnson's house in Racine, and said, Frank, we're all just trying to sit down to Thanksgiving dinner, and the roof is leaking all over everything, and what are you going to do about it? And Frank said, move the table. And that's not an adequate answer for most architects to give to most indignant clients. He got away with it, and everybody forgave him for everything, including the fact that almost invariably, not in the little houses, but in the bigger houses, he went over budget twice, three times, four times. The Johnson Reichs Company building, he was over budget five times the promised prices, and only a very rich company could have afforded that kind of scandalous cost. But Hib Johnson, furious with Wright, within 2 years, was calling him up and pleading with him to design him another building. He never got over how wonderful it was to be in a relationship with this man.
What was his greatest project?
Well, it depends on what you seek. You see, I think the small projects are the greatest, but the most famous projects are certainly the Guggenheim Museum here in New York, the Beth Shalom Synagogue outside Philadelphia, the Johnson Wax Building, a building that I don't like very much at all, which is one of the last buildings he did, the Marin County Civic Center in Marin County, just across the Golden Gate Bridge in California from San Francisco, an enormous mega building that he was beginning to design as he approached the end of his life, that kind of building. But he was a truly American architect in that he did his work all over the country. There hasn't been another architect, even the most famous of them, perhaps to the time of Philip Johnson, whose work was in 20 or 30 or 35 states. You know, that's very exceptional. Most architects work within a very narrow compass.
Was Wright our greatest modern architect?
Oh, I think he was the greatest. He certainly asserted at a very early age that he was the greatest American architect that had ever lived, but that wasn't enough for him. He really wanted to be and asserted that he was the greatest architect that had ever lived. And by that he meant going all the way back to the Greeks and Egyptians. He had no use for architects like Michelangelo or Palladio, people like that. He thought they were all failures, or he claimed that he thought they were all failures, which is the same thing. And he said, I am better than anybody that has ever lived. And he said, I defy anybody to name anything that has been done in architecture in my lifetime that I didn't do first. So by that means he dismissed Le Corbusier and Gropius and Schindler and Neutra and any other architect that you could name.
We're going to need another 50 or 100 or 150 years to make a real true assessment.
Yes, this much at least is true, that he's been dead for almost 30 years, and he's more vividly alive today and more highly thought of today than he was even at the time of his death. So if anything is happening, he's gaining and not losing.
They're still building his houses, aren't they?
And something that's never happened in history before, houses that he wasn't able to persuade anybody to build in his lifetime are now being licensed by the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation to be built. This is a wonderful compliment to a man so long dead. At the same time, it represents, to my mind, a certain danger, because in certain cases, the licensing also permits an increase in the size of the house or a lessening of the size of the house. And I think if you begin to tamper with dimensions, pretty soon it isn't going to be Frank Lloyd Wright's design anymore. That has to be very carefully guarded. And his popularity today is such that he is becoming, or has become, a commodity. His work is a commodity. His name is a commodity. And he is being licensed, not quite yet like a Mickey Mouse, but there is that threat. And I fear the consequences of that kind of commercial popularity. Just one of his dining room chairs sold recently at auction for $195,000. Well, that transforms the nature of anything that you possess. If you have a nice Frank Lloyd Wright house with Frank Lloyd Wright furniture, and find yourself in the possession of something worth millions of dollars, it alters your relationship with that which you possess. And maybe you can't even afford to keep it any longer.
How did you go about researching Minnie Mass?
Well, starting with what I knew, and then with as much family as I knew, and then pursuing as much as possible the parts of the family that he himself had neglected, which is the right side of the family. He devoted himself mostly to pretending to being a Frank Lloyd, Lloyd Jones Wright, I was given great assistance by Susan Woldenberg, who was an architect and photographer who worked much harder than I did on the discovery of the right side of the family. She corresponded with a lot of members of the family, cousins and descendants of cousins of Wright, who had a lot of documentation, which Wright not only didn't know, but didn't want to know. And so we were able to develop for this book information which is of a telling nature, I think, an important nature that nobody has ever seen before.
And this title, what does that mean?
Well, it was the fact that all through his life he seemed to assume a whole series of different masks, and he would put on masks according to what was convenient for him. And this is a theory I have, that all great men do that, and that you can't get your work done if you're a great man without having the liberty of working behind a mask, of fulfilling yourself at your pace, becoming that which you believe yourself capable of becoming, but presenting perhaps a different picture to the world. Not necessarily an evil deception, but a necessary distancing, as they say nowadays, between you and the world. Yeats did that wonderfully. Long before he was a great poet, he was wearing the mask of a poet, and he became a poet behind that mask. And I oversight Hemingway as, for example, having chosen the wrong mask. He was a delicate, exquisite person with a very frangible body. He was always twisting his ankle or breaking something. He ought not to assume the macho mask that he did of the big bully and prize fighter and hard drinker, because behind that mask he collapsed. It was the wrong mask, and he ended his life tragically. But if he had chosen a more suitable mask or a more suitable series of masks, I think he might almost be alive with us today and have been much more fruitful in his lifetime than he was able to be.
Renan Gill, it's a wonderful and illuminating biography, Minnie Mass. Thank you very, very much.
Good pleasure.